You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
Well, we're in for an action-packed morning. It's David McLean here, published or not. And I'm here with my author. Lisa's away, Jan's away, so we're going to have a bit of fun. Where do you go when there's nowhere left to go, when you're trapped in a high-rise building and are chased by killers for the bounty on your head? This is the scenario in Gabriel Bergmoser's latest thriller, High Rise. So, Gabriel, welcome back to 3CR.
Thanks so much for having me back, David.
Now, ex-cop here is Jack Carlin. Who is he? What is he? And why is there a bounty on his head?
So Jack Carlin, he's a character who's appeared in a couple of my earlier books, and I've always just really liked the character and sort of thought there was more mileage in him, and mileage in the form of his own novel, basically. So the setup for Jack is that he's an ex-cop who basically was involved in some pretty dodgy dealings when he was on the force. This led somewhat indirectly to him being removed from the force. And since then, he's been effectively trying to make amends for his pretty egregious mistakes in the possibly inadvisable form of vigilantism. Now, at the start of this book, he's looking for his daughter, who he believes is in some trouble, who he believes the police are looking for. He cracks a few skulls to try to track her down, and one of the skulls he cracks is the wrong skull, leading to a very big bounty on his head that would be tempting to a lot of people.
Well, yeah, in fact, what did you know? He set light to
a meth lab, yep.
A meth lab, but Who does the meth lab belong to?
To the son of a pretty major and pretty loaded drug dealer.
So he could be in some serious trouble here.
Yeah, and it's the kind of trouble that you don't want to end up in when you've tracked your daughter to a dilapidated old high-rise building with elevators out of order and everybody knows exactly where you're going to be on this one night and there's a reward on your head.
Well, he's now looking for his daughter. But again, his daughter, Morgan, is basically compromised herself. And you've got this interesting relationship with her father because Morgan doesn't want to speak to daddy.
No, not at all. And you know, the last thing she wants is her father turning up after she believes he's responsible for a lot of the issues that she's had in her life. And now he's turning up trying to help her. And she immediately sees that he's more than likely here for his own ends. So they start off in this incredibly contentious place where they've both got pasts, they've both got issues, they both have pretty valid reasons for not trusting each other, but they're thrown into a situation where they have no choice but to work together if they're going to survive the night.
But it's interesting. Morgan hates her father, and yet here's Jack trying to protect her. So you're actually playing on a sort of the psychology of parenthood.
Yeah, look, I think the starting point for this, and look, this is going to sound really funny for a book that that sheds as much blood as this one does, but I think a lot of the starting point for this book was the moment that I think happens in every parent-child relationship where mutual humanity has to be recognized. And what I mean by that is it's the moment where the child grows up enough to realize that their parent is just a person themselves. And likewise, I think the parent has to realize at a certain point that their child has grown up and now is their own adult and has to be able to make their own choices. And I think it's a moment that can be really, really hard for both parties, but it's a moment that's necessary for that relationship to grow and develop. And it's a very human moment I think we all face in one form or another. So that's the starting point for the book.
But what happens when your child makes all the wrong choices?
But what happens when the parents made all the wrong choices as well, which Jack absolutely has? Well,
and that's basically compromised.
Yes,
Morgan.
Absolutely.
But Morgan's now into counterfeiting.
Yeah, I had to do a bit of research into that one. I promise this isn't coming from personal experience.
But you've got the lovely line, there's no money in money, sort of thing, as in, you know, you can't make it. And you've actually done the research there because you go into how the Australian currency and the plastic and all of that sort of thing is really difficult to.
And that's what I found so fascinating about it, because the research I had to do into money counterfeiting, the more I delved into it, the more I just thought, who would bother with this? Like, in America, it's easier, but in Australia, you know, that you have to have polymer, you have to sort of replicate the reflective holographic little things in the windows and everything. Australian money is fiendishly hard to replicate, and yet people still do it. Who would bother?
Yeah, it's very, very difficult. But now you also pick up on this psychological element. You've got the father-daughter thing. But Morgan and her ex-boyfriend, and you've developed Brett in such an interesting way because there's been a background there. Brett's sister, who Morgan got on well with, has been compromised and basically ended up in a wheelchair.
In a wheelchair.
But and Brett's partly responsible, but Brett wants to get out of taking the blame. She wants to believe my bullshit story. That's the thing. And if you own up to it, you know she doesn't like it. He says that so casually. It wouldn't have even occurred to her that you'd lie to protect me. Ironic, right? She figures you'd lie about everything else, but if it was to help me, he no longer sounds like he's been crying. Morgs, I know it's ugly, but I actually think this could be a blessing in disguise. It could make our lives so much easier. A bit of discomfort, and we can be together without problems. What a manipulative bastard.
Yeah, I mean, look, I won't go too much into this, but I will touch on it because I think it's important. I think it does lend some of the verisimilitude and weight to the book insofar as there is some. But, I mean, Brett and Morgan's relationship, I've known quite a few addicts in my life, and it's a relationship that is based on, you know, an addiction that pulls them together, and it's very mutually destructive, and that's explored throughout the book. But there is... nobody lies and nobody manipulates like an addict. It's something I've come to learn, and it can be staggering how charming and convincing they can be. And that's something I really, really wanted to explore with Brett. But I also, and I hope I've done this right, I wanted to explore it with some empathy as well, because this isn't an evil thing that's coming from nowhere. This is a thing coming from a mentality that's so warped in one direction that you believe this is justified. And I've seen this firsthand, and I wanted to bring that to the book and explore it in a way that was human while also not shying away from the ugliness of it.
Is it just addicts, though?
No, of course not. Of course not. I mean, manipulation happens everywhere, but I think there is a particular type of manipulation that happens with addicts because there is that one specific end that it's always geared towards.
But now it's compromising Morgan.
Yes.
Because she feels... an affinity, a tie with Brett, but then that compromises the relationship with her father.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, you know, I think addicts seek enablers, and if somebody's in the muck with you, then you're not alone. And also, you know, if you can tie yourself to that person through whatever the means might be, in this case, it's sort of shared guilt or a shared inability to own up to said guilt, then that can be more powerful than just about anything else in some respects.
Yeah, but okay, it could lead to the possibility of Morgan betraying
her father,
who's because now she's being compromised, even though the father is trying to protect.
Well, 100%. Her loyalties are split. And in the end, it's like what I think gives Morgan her humanity, and indeed I think gives Jack his humanity as well, is that there's a father and daughter who on some level are grappling with the same demon, which is guilt. And they're both grappling with the fact that they want to make up for where they've gone wrong in the past without believing they can. And so in the end, the Morgan's real loyalty is to her trying to make amends for her past, which I think makes her very human and kind of empathetic. But the ways in which she goes about that might not be the most...
right way.
Exactly, exactly.
And there's so much we carry guilt for in all of this. But let's move on. The level of violence. Hammer drops his limp mate, turns to him. Please, the bike, he rasps. Please. Hammer walks past him, finds the hatchet, hefts it. Please, he repeats. Hammer brings it down through his face. I'm up now, managing shallow, strangled breaths. Hammer walks towards me. He passes Byrne, also standing, saying something slurred and weak at the wall. Without looking, Hammer grabs the back of his head and smashes it into the wall. The nail disappears. Byrne drops silently. and just for a bit of context, there's been a nail gun and Byrne's had a nail in his head. But that image of this, the head being smashed into the wall and the nail goes through. But the level of violence, my friend, how can you get that?
How do you think of it? I'm going
to
quote Quentin Tarantino here. Somebody confronted him in an interview about this and he said, and this is going to be my best attempt at a Tarantino impersonation, because it's just so much fun. Like, I think that my books are roller coaster rides. They're not designed to be taken 100% seriously. I try to balance it with genuine human development for the characters. But in terms of the action, like, stuff like the hammer and the nail, it's so absurd. There's one scene, in the same scene, somebody's head gets cut, cleaved off with a machete, and then the head is uses a football to kick to take out somebody else by kicking it into their face. This is inviting you to not take it entirely seriously.
But the
you
head
know, you can have a laugh.
Yeah, the head and the football we've probably seen in other scenarios.
Yeah, totally.
But the nail in the head, it's sort of got a visual element to it.
Yeah.
You know, cinematography and such.
Well, I just thought, you know, I don't know. Look, there's certainly an element of black humor, as I think there is to all of my thrillers. But I just, you know, I wanted to put the audience in a situation where at the start, you know, it's this high stakes, high tension situation. And then as the book goes on, the weapons because nobody can use a gun in this building, because if they use a gun, the police will turn up. So the weapons that the criminals are bringing to the building as the night goes on and more organized and more prepared criminals start coming in just get increasingly ridiculous. So we start out with machetes and axes, and we end up with modified nail guns and flamethrowers and all kinds of stuff.
But how do you think of this? Where does the imagination, what are their limits on
okay,
the imagination?
Okay, so the limits of my imagination is the high-rise setting. I pitched this book to my publisher, I sold this book, and then I had to figure out how the hell I was supposed to write it. And I couldn't figure out how to plan it, I couldn't figure out how to make it interesting and distinct, to make it not repetitive, even though it was stuck in the building the whole time. And so what I did was something I've never done before, and I made the whole thing up as I went along. I started writing it with a setup of they're in the building, criminals at the bottom, they're at the top, nobody can use a gun, what happens, how do they get out? And then it was like playing constant mental chess with myself. And so I used that Breaking Bad technique of not planning anything, but trying to write my characters into the hardest situations I could think of, and then try to write my way out of it. And part of that was coming up with more and more insane weapons. And also, you know, because you don't want to be repetitive, by using different weapons, that requires different means of combating said weapons, which I think creates, I hope a level of inventiveness in the violence that hopefully sends eyebrows skyrocketing with every
now,
new iteration.
We haven't got much time left, but I am going to have to take you to task.
Oh,
here
we go.
I'm an old repatriated English teacher. This is very extremely not good. I mean, the grammar, my friend, the grammar. But it's iconic in terms of that character.
Yes, and it's what he would say. It's like, my dad always calls me to task about the fact that Jack Carlin smokes and swears like a sailor. And I'm like, he's an ex-undercover cop who's lived in the muck for years. Like, his grammar's not going to be perfect. You know, his language is not going to be free of profanities. He's not going to not have vices. Like, the guy, you know, you've got to believe this guy to an extent. And part of the fun of this book is that it's written in the first person from Jack and Morgan's perspectives, and neither of them are, you know, characters who would be speaking perfectly. So you can kind of get to write it in their voices with all the roughness and the imperfections that would come with that.
And that's what you've got. You've got the two narratives going.
Yes.
Jack's voice, Morgan's voice. But what does that allow you to do?
Well, it allows you to contrast their perspectives, and it allows you to be in both of their heads, and the conflict becomes a lot more real and alive because we're seeing both their sides of the same thing. So hopefully, if I've done my job right, as the conflict gets sort of explored, you as the reader go, well, I get both sides of it, but I also, you know, I get why they're both heroes and they're both villains at the same time. And I think we all have a bit of both in us, so I think that makes them more human and grounds the chaos a little bit.
And the last thing I want to touch on is Magnus. You put out this little teaser, and we don't know what Magnus is. We can't actually explain what
I can't spoil it.
We find out, but it's like, and the first one Jack takes out says Magnus before he goes.
Yes.
And then this keeps echoing. And what does that do to the reader?
Well, hopefully it just creates a question. I mean, I think you always start with a question. You hopefully create a desire in the reader to have the question answered. And then you tease it out through the book. You add new dimensions. You complicate it. And then, you know, if you want them to come back for the next book, you answer it at the end. You know, don't cheat them out of that answer.
So you've got all of this action. You've got all of this absurdity in the one tower. No guns. Unless you consider nail guns. You've got smoke, fire hydrants, knives, and you've got a bikie gang, which we can't go into. And it's just extreme, and it just gets larger and larger and larger until, well, they all live happily ever after, of course.
Oh, yeah, of course. It's a nice, comfortable ending for everyone, you know.
There is betrayal, there is corruption, there is unprecedented violence. All good fodder for a diverting read on a rainy day, so I was reading it while the rain was coming down. The book is called High Rise, the author, Gabrielle Bergmoser, and it's a HarperCollins release. So, Gabrielle, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me back.
And now we're going to go into Lisa's interview with Rachel Johns. If I can get it to play.
Rachel Johns is a best-selling, award-winning author of 9 books of women's fiction and romance. Today she's here to talk about her latest book, Lucky Sisters. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you, Lisa. It's great to be here.
The adopted twins, Nora and Stevie, in Lucky Sisters, and their surname is also Lucky, have always been close, despite being total opposites. But when their mother dies, Nora convinces Stevie to search for their biological parents, only to come face to face with a life-changing revelation that sends them spiralling in opposite directions. Now, Rachel, was there a particular spark or a personal experience that set Lucky Sisters in motion?
Well, I think the spark was definitely first, but I think it is quite a personal book, and I'll explain that in a second. But the spark was a newspaper article, actually. My friend was reading on the ABC app when we were away, and she read an article. Well, firstly, she saw, unfortunately, the news that Lisa Marie Presley had died quite young. And then she read an article that was related to that. And I can't say too much or it will give, you know, quite a lot of the story away. But we were at breakfast when she said, I think this would make a really good, novel, which sounds like one of your books. And I was like at first, oh, no, I don't think so. But then over that breakfast, we started playing this sort of typical writer what if game. And it was what if this has sort of happened to you? How would you feel? And then what if you're adopted? Hang on, what if they were twins who were adopted and this happened to them? So that was the initial spark of inspiration.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That sounds so intriguing. I like the what if game for author's play.
Well, I think it is. You know, we do, I think, even subconsciously. I mean, you probably know that yourself.
Yeah, that's right. Your brain sort of goes down a rabbit hole, doesn't it? And I guess that's always the beginning of a novel.
Yes.
So there's a component to this that asks you to really suspend disbelief, and you have used sort of more of a creative license as a writer this time around in your work, and you go sort of beyond the naturalistic, would you say?
Yeah, definitely. I do think exactly what you said. Some people have to suspend disbelief. Others will completely be there for the ride.
Okay. Mm-hmm. How would you classify the genre of this book?
Yeah, that's a really tough question, because I think it does, like, I guess it mostly sits in general contemporary fiction. But as you mentioned, there are sort of some elements that I haven't really played with before, and I think they're almost described as magic realism.
Okay, of course, yes. Mm. Okay. So this is a bit of a departure, really, in a sense. It's kind of, or a development for you as an author. Do you feel that with each book you're looking for something sort of a bit different? Or
definitely. Like, obviously, I want to write a book that my readers will feel is me, and that they, the ones who are, you know, comfortable and love my type of work, they'll feel like, oh yes, this is definitely a Rachel Johns novel. But I also want to grow as a writer each time, and I want to write stories that are not the same every single time.
Of course.
I don't, so, you know, each book, I'm not sure whether I consciously think, oh, what can I do differently or what can I play with? But some books sort of lend themselves to that. And this one, I never realised when I first started with the concept that would have those magical element sort of aspects. I'm trying to be very hard not to say spoilers. And I remember writing them, those chapters, and they just felt so perfect. Like, not perfect as in there's nothing wrong with them and I didn't need to change them, but they just felt like they suited the story I was telling so much, and they made it so different to what I would have imagined, but sort of elevated it. But I do remember sending the chapters to my publisher and thinking she's going to say, what on earth is this? You write general, you know, realistic fiction, and you've gone, you know, a little bit differently in the other way. And she would say to me, you know, don't do this. So I was ready to fight for it, because I do think those chapters really are what make the book better than it would have been without them. But she didn't. She said, oh my goodness, I absolutely love this. Some of the best things I've ever read that you've written. So I was really lucky. But that kind of, it just came, if that makes sense. Mm. Like, and as soon as I had a totally different other idea where the book was going, but as soon as that idea came, I was just, yes, this is what it's supposed to be. And my next book I'm writing again is quite different. It's a sliding doors type narrative, but that is providing its own, you know, unique challenges. And so I do think it's good to sort of stretch your writer's brain by playing with different aspects of storytelling each time.
Mm, oh, absolutely. It's fascinating. And you, can I take you back? You just mentioned that this sort of feeling that you got when you wrote those first scenes, And what can you describe that feeling? Is it something that you think, oh, I know this is right? What is that?
It's so hard to describe, isn't it? Because it was different. I think maybe that's why I thought, because it was not something that I could have kind of come up with beforehand and thought this is what I'm going to do. It came organically with the characters and as the plot grew. And I do believe, I think this sounds a bit woo-woo, but I've got a tattoo on my arm that says trust the magic. And I believe there's an element of magic in writing. It's more, it could say trust your subconscious instead. But, you know, so the butterfly aspect kind of ties into the magic realism aspect, I guess. And I got this cover before I started writing the book. Now, that's very rare in the publishing world, as you probably know.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, completely crazy. And I had this idea that there was going to be a dragonfly motif sort of throughout, that the twin sisters would have dragonfly tattoos. And that went back from something, an event where someone had told me about dragonflies and said, you should put them in the book. So I said, okay, I'll give it a go. But then I got this cover with the butterfly on it. And the publisher said, look, I know you're going to do dragonflies. We can change that if you want, but this is the sort of the look we're going for. And I fell in love with the butterfly. And I said, no, it's okay. We'll do butterflies. And I don't think the scenes that we're talking about would quite have worked with dragonflies.
No.
And there was a whole load of other things that sort of butterfly meanings that came into different parts of the book. So, yeah, I do believe that there's almost a magic. This book felt like one of those fairy dust books. And sadly, as writers, we don't get them very often. Maybe, you know, every 6 or 7 books. And it's not that it wasn't hard to write, but it just really felt like I was writing what I was meant to write. Is that make
yeah,
sense?
That's great. Yeah. Oh, that's absolutely fascinating. It's interesting that the cover was almost like a writing prompt.
Yeah, it was. And I have had that for my last 2 books, actually, which, as I said, I don't know if I'll get it again.
Maybe this is your secret weapon.
Maybe it is. I should get onto my publisher and say, give me a cover now. Yeah. But yeah, no, it is. I think it did really help shape this story. But yeah, again, it's very rare. So maybe it was just meant to happen that way.
Mm. So let's talk about a little bit about the title. So the Lucky Sisters, there's an undercurrent in the novel that suggests that luck isn't random.
Mm.
But also, you know, luck can mean so many different things.
That's true.
It can be fortune, fate, and even irony.
Yeah.
So what sort of choices did you make with this title? I mean, is it tied to the relationships first, or what made you decide on the title for this?
I really wish I kept a diary when writing sometimes and like noted down these decisions, because it's hard after the fact to sometimes know what came first.
That's right.
But I'm pretty sure, so I wasn't, this was not my working title for the novel.
Okay.
It was The Last Day of Your Life, which I still quite like, but yeah, my publisher, as soon as she heard that the sisters in the book were called the Luckies, or Stevie and Nora Lucky, she just went, the Lucky Sisters is such a great title. The word lucky is a good, you know, I think in publishing we all sort of are very aware that there are buzzwords in titles, you know, as sisters is one, mother is one, Paris is one, you know, Outback is one, and lucky is quite good apparently as well. So she's like, we have to call it the Lucky Sisters.
Yeah, it's a great title. I'm learning so much from you. I didn't know that there were these buzzwords like sisters was one. Okay.
There's actually a really good book called The Bestseller Code. And it has a section on titles, and it's very fascinating.
Oh, my God. Okay.
But personally, I like titles that are a little more, you know, not just the something something. I like a quirky title myself. So that's why I really like The Last Day of Your Life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was playing with that phrase, you know, live every day like it's the last day of your life.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, The Lucky Sisters has obviously worked.
I hope so.
So each sister, let's go in to talk a little bit about the characters. So you've got Stevie and Nora and they're adopted twins, as you say.
Yeah.
Each sister feels really distinct, and yet their shared story and their shared history ties them together in complicated ways. How did you find each of their voices, and what guided you in balancing their individual arcs?
Well, again, no pun intended, I was kind of pretty lucky that I stumbled across a quote about sisters sort of early on. I think it was even before I started. It was before I started writing it, because this book, I had the idea for the book, in early 2023, and yet I didn't write it till the end of 2024, kind of thing. So there was
that's fast.
Well, I know, but for me, that's quite not the idea that it was sort of a whole idea. And so for me, often then I would like, you know, write that one next, but sort of two other books had to be written first because I'd been contracted for them. So the idea was like buzzing around kind of in my head for many years. And I had a Pinterest board. So I always do a Pinterest board at the beginning of each writing project kind of thing. And it's more because I'm not very visual. And so I like choosing, you know, a celebrity or some person that is on the internet that I can say, you're the character, so that I remember what they look like. But I also really like on Pinterest sort of looking up quotes and sayings and things like that about topics in my book. So I looked up sisters and I found the best quote, and that sort of shaped the whole book for me and these characters. So it was, when there are two sisters, one is always the watcher and one is always the dancer. And I've since talked to you're looking. You've got an interesting look on your face.
I'm a sister. Yeah. I'm a sister. Yeah. I think my sister Amy and I we're probably both dancers, but I'm definitely the dancer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah. That's such
a
fascinating thing.
I've definitely talked
yeah.
to like especially twins and stuff. My friend who I'm co-writing a novel with, Mercedes Mercier, she has twin one-year-olds, and you know you can definitely see it. And I've, you know, whenever I've talked about this at events, people's eyes suddenly, and often they're there with the sister and they look at each other and then they'll tell me afterwards, you know. So, but I also think, so that was my sort of the sort of thing that gave me the really strong idea of, well, Nora is going to be the watcher. She's a little bit more sensible. She's cautious more. She'll think things through. And Stevie, I guess the dancer is sort of the life of the party, who's, you know, doesn't necessarily plan ahead and is just, you know, living one day to the next, enjoying herself. But saying that, I think as a writer, you know, especially when you're writing characters of similar, well, these two, exactly the same age, same gender, grew up in the same family, you know, same era and all this sort of stuff, you have to really work hard to distinguish them. And that was sort of just this little trick that came to me, watcher and dancer.
Oh, that's so perfect and so simple.
Yeah, and then the fun thing about it was I knew from the very beginning that they would be the watcher and dancer, but what they found out would kind of switch their personalities so that
they did, yes.
The other one would become, you know, the watcher and the dancer. And that sort of, it's irritating because they're seeing the other person in the way they always have been themselves, but not irritated by themselves like that, if that makes sense.
Wow, there is so much that we could chat about this. And what I'd really like to do now, though, before we finish, is would you mind just reading the prologue so the listener has got an idea of, like, you know, what they can get from the experience?
Sure, I'll give it a go. So prologue of The Lucky Sisters. Nora and Stevie were lucky by name and lucky by nature. At least that's what they'd been told throughout their 49 years. They almost always won something on scratchies, never a big amount, but still, were often the recipients of raffle prizes and more than once have been upgraded from economy to business, or in Nora's case, from business to first. Except, as Nora had very sensibly pointed out ever since they found out they were adopted, lucky shouldn't have been their real name. And no matter how lucky a person was, there was one thing they couldn't avoid. No one was lucky enough to escape death.
Awesome. Great, great beginning. So thank you, Rachel Johns, for being my guest today on Published or Not. It was such a pleasure to have you in the studio with me.
Thank you so much, Lisa, and I'm so looking forward to next year reading your debut novel.
Oh, thank you. So let's just recap. It's called The Lucky Sisters, Rachel Johns, and it's published by Penguin Random House. Thank you.